about six characteristics of an effective church leader, and just picking out some things we see in Paul in this scripture. Of course, we've been on this for a while and really talking a lot about spiritual leadership and church leadership as we see it modeled in Paul and his dealing with the Corinthians. So this is a good chapter here with a lot of meat. But just starting out, have you ever done something, either good or bad, where someone has misjudged your motives for it? Anybody got any stories they'd like to share? Oh, come on. What about you? You ever done something where somebody's misjudged your motives?
Well, how many times? I'm sure.
Yeah?
Every time somebody thought out my motives were impure, they misjudged them. I'm sure.
Well, I could tell you a few stories myself. I remember right after I became a Christian, I was at in Tampa at a Bible study, and we were with a bunch of college students, of course, and I was brand new to the group, and they were doing a lesson on purity, and I noticed one of these girls would just cry through the whole lesson. You know, they were talking about sexual purity, and so after it was done, she was a friend of mine, so I went up to her and said, "Hey, you know, what's wrong? Are you feeling guilty?" And she just bursts into tears and just runs in a back room and doesn't come out. And all these girls are going back and talking to her. And, you know, that was a really stupid thing to say. But nothing malicious really was meant by it. I remember Coach Tatum. You remember Redis Tatum in Arkansas. He was a coach of mine in high school. And he had polio as a little kid. And as a result, got around on crutches. And he thought if you were going around a corner, if you were too close to the wall when you went around that corner, he just knew that you were trying to knock him down because he was going to be coming down that hall at some point. And so for every person he saw going around a corner too closely, he would stop them and kind of chew on them a little bit because he just knew that their motive was to knock somebody down. And so, you know, obviously it wasn't for a lot of people, but he just was kind of misjudging their motives. Now, we've all fallen victim to this at some point in our lives. And that happened to Paul, too. And 1 Corinthians 9 is basically an entire chapter written to a group of people, more than likely, it could have been an individual, more than likely a group of people in Corinth who had misjudged Paul's motives for ministry and for being a church leader. And so he's responding to this charge that they had apparently leveled against him. But let's go ahead and dig into the text. We're going to start out this first slide here, the first two verses, 1 Corinthians 9, 1 and 2. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not the result of my work? Even though I may not be an apostle to others, surely I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. So apparently there's people here who are making the claim that Paul is not a real Christian leader. He's not really somebody they should be listening to. Now, we've already dealt with this in chapters 1 through 4. There were obviously these factions that were divided according to different leaders that had come through Corinth. But Paul basically lets them know that he is an apostle, and all that is somebody that's sent from the Lord, and that their coming to know Jesus was proof of his apostleship. So he goes into this city where people didn't know Jesus and leaves, and there's a church there as a result of his word. That in itself is proof of his apostleship. And it also appears in this next section, he really gets into the part where people are obviously judging his motives. But do you guys remember in 1 Corinthians 4 where we talked about this a little bit? People misjudging motives. You remember what it says there? Let's read this real quick. She says, I care very little, in 1 Corinthians 4 starting in verse 3, I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear. But that does not make me innocent. It's the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each will receive his praise from God. Do you guys remember this? What's he saying right here?
Judgment doesn't belong to man.
Yeah, it really doesn't. You can't see inside my heart, is basically what he's saying. So if you have a problem with what you think are my motives, why don't you just wait and let God judge me because you can't see. Okay, he can't. So is it wise to judge someone's motives for doing something? You really can't see, can you? There's not a lot of wisdom in it, according to what he says right there, because God can see it. So go ahead and hit that next slide. And here's where he gets into this. He says, "This is my defense to those who sit in judgment on me. Don't we have the right to food and drink? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas? Or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk? Do I say this merely from a human point of view? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it's written in the law of Moses, 'Do not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain.' Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes, this was written for us, because when the plowman plows and the thresher threshes, they ought to do so in hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have the right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? But we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in what is offered on the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel." Okay, so you've got this group of people in Corinth who are attacking his motives. We don't know the letter that the Corinthians originally sent him that he's responding to, but it's very obvious as we read further that this is what's going on. And basically, he defends his ministry and his motivation for ministry by highlighting what he'd given up in order to reach the Corinthians. So look at what he says here. What did he give up? In verse 4, it says he gave up the right to have his food provided for him. In verse 5, it says he gave up the right to take a wife. In verse 6, he has to work for a living, so he gave up time. He worked as a tent maker in addition to fulfilling his duties as an apostle. In verse 7, he was a soldier who gave up his right to a salary. He was a vineyard worker who gave up his right to eat of the grapes. He was a shepherd who gave up his right to drink milk from the flock. In verse 9, he was an ox who gave up his right to share in eating the grain. In verse 10, he's a plowman and thresher who didn't share in the harvest. In verse 11, he was a sower of seed who wasn't sharing in the fruit of his labor. In verse 13, he's a temple worker who wasn't sharing in food from the temple. So he uses this common sense argument to drive home the point that his motives in coming to the Corinthians were pure. He actually had the right to be paid, but he gave it up. And he proved he had the right to be paid using common sense, and then he appeals to the Jewish law to further drive home that point. So a little side note here, what does this passage tell us about ministers being paid for their work?
It's biblical.
It's biblical. Isn't it? Yeah. Now, there's a school of thought out there right now that says that this is not a biblical concept. Kind of led by Frank Viola in Pagan Christianity, which he nails a lot of stuff in that book, but he gets this wrong. It's okay to have paid ministers. It's a biblical thing, okay? Paul is an example of this. I've heard of churches that pay preachers badly on purpose to make sure that they're not in ministry for the wrong reasons. And that's kind of screwed up. I don't think you should get rich in ministry. I don't think you ever will. Some of these guys hit a home run with a book every now and then. Warren, what's his name? Rick Warren's a good example of that. He actually took the money and paid back the church that he'd worked for, which is kind of cool. But most of the guys aren't going to get rich in ministry. But I don't think you should have to just barely claw your way by either. You know, I don't think you should have to be in debt your whole life. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. Ministers ought to be able to make a living from the gospel. That is a biblical concept. And Paul's letting them know that he has a right to be paid for his work. Well, let me ask you another question. Why does Paul accept money from other churches but doesn't accept it from this church in Corinth? We know from other passages of Scripture that he accepted money from the Philippians. He accepted money from other churches that supported him in his ministry. So he was getting an income. Maybe not at this point. He apparently was working as a tent maker. But at other times in his life, he was getting an income from churches. Why didn't he accept money from the Corinthians? Anybody want to hazard a guess?
Well, he insinuates he doesn't want to hinder the gospel.
Okay. Why would that hinder the gospel? You have any idea?
Well, because they misjudged his motives.
Okay.
There was, as you said, as you pointed out, we obviously don't have the document that raises the question, makes the accusations. But undoubtedly, he has been accused of seeking his own gain and to line his own pocket and promote himself.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps as evidence that that is just not so, he is able to say, I haven't taken anything from you.
Okay, I think that may be part of it. Look at verse 12. If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? A little something about Corinthian culture you need to understand that I think may answer our question here, why he doesn't ask them for money. We've talked a lot about these traveling sophists and these philosophers and these rhetoricians that would come to Corinth and the Isthmian games and how they would participate in those along with the poets and musicians and how rhetoric was such a big deal and public speaking was such a big deal, such a huge form of entertainment in Corinth. One of the things these sophist teachers would do is when they would come to Corinth, they would actually charge for people to come and listen to their teaching. And if you were really enamored with what they were saying and wanted to learn more, you could become a private student of theirs, and you would have to actually pay more to come and sit at their feet and learn from them. And that's how these guys would make their money. They would go around to different places, and Corinth was kind of a central place for this kind of activity. They would get paid for their teaching. Okay? If Paul had accepted money from the Corinthians, it could be that they would have lumped him in with all these other traveling teachers of wisdom that were coming through the city. And he wouldn't have been a whole lot different than every other philosopher that was coming along. Okay? That could be. It could be that he wanted to set himself apart from these rhetoricians and philosophers. And so that's why he doesn't accept the money, because for him it wasn't about the money. It was about the message. The presence of these philosophers that I'm talking about wasn't near as prevalent in other places in the ancient world as it was in Corinth. Now, some cities would have been the exception, like Athens would have been the exception probably, but you know, not most places. And so I wonder if that didn't have something to do with this. We really don't know for sure, but you know, that's kind of what I think. Now, up to this point, the Corinthians may have thought that Paul was about to ask them to please pay him. Okay, like all of this had been leading up to, oh, by the way, you're supposed to be paying me. Can you please? But let's read on. That's not what happens. In verse 15, he says, but I have not used any of these rights, and I'm not writing this in the hope that you will do such things for me, as in paying me. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of this boast. Excuse me. Verse 16. Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge, and so not make use of my rights in preaching. So he's basically saying, some of you are attacking my motives in coming to you, but this reveals my true motive. I didn't even accept payment from you, even though I deserve it. And I'm not in this for myself. I'm in this to share the gospel. Okay? So stop bad-mouthing my motives. I'm here for you. That's kind of what he says up to this point. So what is Paul saying to the Corinthians in arguing this way? If they believe this, what are they going to think he thinks about them? Is he in this for the money? Who's he in it for?
Them.
He's in it for the Corinthians. Okay? He genuinely cares for the Corinthians. That's what he's trying to get across to them. You know, my motive isn't money. My motive is my love for you. I want you to know Jesus. That is my motive. You know, and he's basically willing to give up personal rights in order to accomplish that. Now, verse 15, he says, I'm not using any of these rights, and I'm not writing this in hope that you'll do such things for me. I'd rather die than have anyone deprive me of this boast. And that boast is, you know, I'm not taking money for this, and I want to keep that to myself. I don't want your money. This ties back into what we studied in the last chapter. People were wanting, in chapter 8, to exercise their right to eat meat. But according to Paul, there are some things more important than your liberty to exercise your right. And he models this in giving up his pay. Carrying out the mission of Jesus to him, reconciling the lost world to God, is more important to Paul than getting paid. And he wants it to be more important to the Corinthians than their right to eat meat sacrificed to an idol. So it kind of is a continuation of what we hear in chapter 8. Verse 16, he says, "Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I'm compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel." Anybody remember that scripture in Jeremiah 20? 20 and verse 9, where Jeremiah says, "I will not mention him or speak any more in his name. His word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones. You know, I just have to get it out." That's kind of the same thing Paul is saying here. It's like, what's that?
It's called a holy bone fire.
A holy bone fire. Where'd you learn that?
Instead of bonfire.
Oh, instead of a bonfire? Holy bone fire. I have to remember that. That'd be a good name for a Christian band right there. What do you think? The holy bone fire. So basically, he can't help himself. I mean, he's so crazy in love with Jesus that he just has to tell people about it. He just cannot help it. Verse 17 and 18, what's his reward? In all this? Preaching the gospel for free. That's what he says. But is that it? Is that his only reward? I think that's part of it. I think it's the result of what he sees. Preaching the gospel is awesome, but what is he seeing as a result of the gospel being preached? What is his reward? I think all those people whose lives he's seeing that are changed as a result of his preaching the gospel. Just to really feel like God is using him in the world. God is fulfilling something through him. That's an amazing thing. That is rewarding. That is very rewarding. He kind of touches on this in Colossians 2 and 3. He says, "My purpose is that they may be encouraged in heart and united in love, so that they may have the full riches of complete understanding, in order that they may know the mystery of God, namely Christ." You hear that? Colossians says, "My purpose is that people will know Jesus." That's my purpose in this world. And I think that's his reward. When he sees that purpose being fulfilled, that is very rewarding to Paul. So it's not just the teaching, it's the result. Now, he's a great example of an effective church leader. He is just a really good example of an effective church leader. And there are a few characteristics that I see up to this point. First of all, he's Jesus-centered. Paul is a Jesus-centered guy. His identity, his view of the world, his priorities, his way of life, it all goes back to Jesus for Paul. And he lives out this Jesus-centered life that we talked about last Sunday. And he's evangelistic at his core because a Jesus-centered person is going to be evangelistic. And he models this. He also, number two, genuinely cares about people. His commitment to the Corinthians was for their own good. It wasn't for him. It wasn't about him. It was about them. And he made sacrifices, number three, to reach people. Paul makes sacrifices to reach people. He gives up his own rights so that he'll not be hindered in sharing the gospel with the Corinthians. He's not worried about himself. He's worried about them. He's worried about their welfare. He really wants to reach people. So let's read on verse 19. Says, "Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings." In verse 19, he's free from a lot of things. He says, "Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible." When he came to Jesus, he gained freedom from a lot of things. He gained freedom from sin. He gained freedom from the material world. He gave freedom from a self-centered worldview. He gained freedom from the fires of hell. I mean, you could just make this list of all these things that he gained freedom from. But what did he gain freedom for? He gained freedom from a lot of things, but what did he gain freedom for? He gained freedom for the mission of Jesus. And that's what he's carrying out in his life, to reconcile the world to God. I mean, that is what he gained freedom for. He says to the Jews in verse 20, I became like a Jew to win Jews. So he would observe these Jewish customs when he was with the Jews, like Sabbath, following the law, and this helped him minister to the Jews. He gave up his right to skip Sabbath on Saturdays, and to, you know, skip out on some of these other customs. He just gave that up. But when he was with the Gentiles in verse 21, he became like a Gentile, or like one that was not under the law, to win those not under the law. He didn't follow those Jewish customs when he was with Gentiles. That would have set him apart. The Gentiles would have been like, oh, look, there's another uppity Jew. You know, why should we listen to him? So he probably just, you know, wouldn't follow the customs when he was with them so that he could reach them. He didn't parade his freedom from the law around in front of the Jews. He didn't, you know, parade his Jewishness around in front of the Gentiles. And that verse 22, the weak and strong, that's a callback to the weaker brother lesson we went over last week. In verse 23, I do all this for the sake of the gospel. He would adapt his approach to different groups so that he could reach different groups with the same gospel. Isn't that interesting? So the message was the same. Now, have you guys ever noticed in Acts, when Paul would speak with the Jews, he would normally start with the Old Testament, and he would lead into Jesus. But when he would talk to the Gentiles, he would start with the God of creation and lead to Jesus. So he would start in different places with different groups of people, but he would always lead to Jesus. That's something that's called contextualization. It's basically just packaging the gospel in such a way that it's going to be easy to communicate to whoever you're talking to. So you, you know, take your audience into consideration. In order to do that, Paul needed to know a little something about the people he was talking to before he talked to them. Okay, when he went to the Areopagus in Acts 17, he knew about the philosophers at the Areopagus and kind of how they operated before he went there. And then he started with their own god, the statue of to an unknown god. He started with that idol and led them to Jesus. So he started where they were and led them to Jesus. That's contextualization. Now, what does that look like today? Think about the people around here in San Francisco. In order to reach them effectively, would it be wise maybe to know a thing or two about it before we tried to reach them?
Yes.
Think so? I think so too. I think so too. I think it's important to know that, you know, demographics, people's hurts, hang-ups, what they need, marriage situations, whether they have kids or not, you know, who you're talking to is going to affect how you package the gospel. There's not this set, inflexible evangelistic approach that you have to take with everybody. The gospel is kind of like a liquid. You can pour it into different shaped containers, but the contents, even though the container may be shaped different, the content is still water. It's the same with the gospel. You can pour the gospel into different cultures, and even though the cultural container may be a different shape, the gospel still fits any culture. It is transcultural. But how you package it may be a little bit different. Okay, that's contextualization. So there's a couple of additional characteristics we see here. Paul is a servant. He shows that church leadership is more about fighting your way to the bottom to serve than it is about fighting your way to the top to rule. That's what Paul shows us here. He says that he's free, but that he makes himself a slave to people for the gospel. He also, the fifth one I see here, is he makes the message of Jesus relevant to the lives of those he's trying to reach. That's that contextualization we're talking about. He meets people where they are and leads them to Jesus. He approaches people different based on their values and backgrounds and hurts and hang-ups, but he leads them to Jesus. He may just start in a different place. It's important for us to learn how to do that. Go ahead and hit that next slide. Last little bit here of chapter 9, verse 24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. All right, verse 24. Why does he use this illustration?
We just talked about the Isthmian Games.
Okay, that's right. And he just talked about contextualization. And then he talks about the Isthmian Games, basically. He alludes to them, which the Corinthians would have been very, very familiar with. You know, it's like talking to a Giants fan and relating baseball, Giants baseball, to Jesus somehow. That's basically what he's doing here. This is a good example of contextualization. Corinth was the home of these Isthmian Games, so they would have been very familiar with athletes and athletic competition. But also, what's the prize in verse 24? Huh? Jesus? Okay. An eternity with Jesus. That's right. Heaven, being with God. I think all those are kind of saying the same thing. Verse 25, he says, everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. What's the strict training that he's talking about as it relates to our spiritual lives? What is he talking about?
I think it's discipline.
Okay.
It's a focused approach. It's making use of every moment and every opportunity to be successful and to be prepared to be successful.
Okay. So you're saying spiritual discipline, you're saying taking advantage of opportunities, being disciplined and taking advantage of opportunities. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Well, the strictness of the training, the athlete doesn't say to himself, you know, I've got to get around to getting started, getting training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I 3 or 4 weeks from now, I'm going to start taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
He takes it seriously from the time and the commitment to run the race.
Okay.
And the training, the strictness, it's the orientation that says there is a serious commitment to what I am doing in order to succeed at the race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't a someday I've got to get around to getting my act together.
Okay, I think you're right. Well, let me ask you, picture Michael Phelps when he was training for Beijing. How many gold medals did he win? Eight? Something crazy like that before he started smoking weed. Now he can't win anything. Y'all heard about that, right? He lost that, yeah. Anyway, think about his life as a whole in leading up to Beijing. What aspect of his life did the Olympic Games affect?
Every minute.
Every minute? It affected what he thought about. It affected what he ate. It affected how he spent his time. It affected, you know, how many hours he would put into actually working out. It affected how much he would spend in the swimming pool. It probably affected who he hung out with. He probably didn't hang out with a lot of guys, like the ones maybe he was hanging out with in North Carolina a few weeks ago, leading up to Beijing. A better question may be, what aspect of his life didn't it affect? Because it affected pretty much everything about him, right? It's probably the same way for these athletes in Corinth back then. I mean, this would have been like Olympic training for these guys. It would have affected every aspect of their life. So this could mean a number of things. Now this crown that it talks about in verse 25. This is another thing. They do it to get a crown that will not last. And then it's that crown of reeds. Or whatever kind of leaves that is.
Laurel.
Not reeds. Laurel leaves.
It's laurel.
Yeah. Laurel crown that they put around their head. Now that's another thing that would have been very familiar with these Corinthians. They didn't know that just died. Just dried up and died after a while. What's the big deal with that? He says you're fighting for something. You're training for something that's going to last forever. Verse 26. Run like a saying we're to go through life with a purpose, not aimlessly. And I think this discipline that he's referring to, strict training in verse 25, feeds into our purpose. So this isn't purposeless. We're looking ahead. We have a goal in mind. Paul wants to advance the gospel in his own life in addition to advancing it in the lives of other people.
Amen.
I think verse 26 also indicates the reality of a race. Running aimlessly would be training, just running up hills, not running for a finish line, but running to get in shape, mm-hmm. and fighting, this NIV version says, shadow boxing. That's what boxers do, is they get prepared for the ring. And so what he's saying is, this is a real, real race we're in. It's real. It's not just getting conditioned, mm-hmm. but it's actually being in the fight.
I like that. I like that. So it kind of highlights that goal. You know, there is an end to it. I see what you're saying. I like that.
Well, there is, in further to this point, there is a difference. There's a huge difference in the guy that just runs because he likes to run, as opposed to the guy who's running because he is preparing to compete in some event.
Yeah.
There is a huge difference in the guy that is stepping into the ring, as opposed to any guy who can stand in the shadow box.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, both of them may have the appearance of the athlete, mm-hmm. but the difference is, He says, don't be the one that is just going through the motions. It's real, but it is and he says that in 27.
Mm-hmm. I didn't say shadows don't hit back either.
Shadows don't hit back.
But sometimes you get hit in the shadows.
Really?
It's just kind of things that sunset.
Well, this last verse here, he says, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. That beat my body can also be translated treat roughly. But basically, I think the point that he's making is that he's willing to make his spiritual body endure this training, this strict training that he's talking about. He's willing to suffer discomfort in order to achieve this goal. Because, let's be honest, sometimes it's just easier to give in to sin. Sometimes it's just easier to give in to sin when you're going through life. And Paul's saying, you know, that's no excuse. If you're going to be uncomfortable, if it's going to be uncomfortable to do the right thing sometimes, you need to do the right thing. So the point of this section is, when it comes to knowing Jesus, and when it comes to serving Jesus, man, go all out. I really think that's what he's saying here. Just go all out. Be like an athlete that's training for the Olympics. I mean, go as hard as you can. Get as close to God as possible. Do all you can to advance the kingdom. I mean, that's really what I hear him saying here. You don't do that to be saved. You do it because you are saved. Okay? So the final characteristic that I see here, number six, is Paul really sets high spiritual standards. He really does. He teaches grace, but he doesn't teach grace without commitment. Every time, he really hammers this home. You don't have to work to be saved, but because you are saved, you really ought to strive to do as much as you can for the kingdom as possible. You ought to train your spiritual body just like an Olympic athlete trains his physical body. You just need to get out there and get after it. That's what he's telling these Corinthians. That's a kind of an intense attitude, isn't it? There's a big difference between these Pharisees and the Gospels who are tying up heavy loads on people, telling them you need to be perfect. There's a difference between that and Paul telling people you need to strive to be perfect. And you're not going to be, but you need to strive for it. I think there's a big difference between those two messages. And effective church leaders that I've observed all do this. They really push people to strive for perfection, even though nobody's going to achieve it. Okay? And that's the last characteristic that I see of a really effective church leader here. So anyway, that wraps up chapter 9, and we'll hit chapter 10, not next week, but the week after, I think.